try it again.
Didn't work, not your fault. There we go. Okay. The second case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Kent Jackson. Mr. Jackson is the appellant. For the appellant is Mr. Thomas Diggins of the Pennington County Public Defender's Office. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Andrew Connect, Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. Mr. Diggins, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Thomas Diggins. I am the attorney for Mr. Kent Jackson, defendant and appellant in this matter. My intention this morning is to spend the majority of my time on Justice Konenkamp's recent decision in State v. Morse. Because the Attorney General did not address that opinion in their brief, I do intend to touch on points made by Chief Justice Gilbertson in his dissenting opinion and also a point made by Justice Sinter in his concurring opinion. I think that it's very clear that in addressing sufficiency of the evidence, we have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party. And in reading the Attorney General's brief, the points that I believe they made was, first of all, that the down payment that Mr. Jackson received was not used to purchase materials, that Mr. Jackson admitted at trial that he spent $5,000 of that, which he claimed was profit. Mr. Jackson admitted that he did not order the materials. He admitted that he did not rent a machine once he knew that he could not purchase one. And also that Mr. Jackson accused the Eppersons of breaching the contract once they contacted law enforcement with their complaints. Now, taking the first of those issues, I think that this is where Justice Zinter's concurring opinion is helpful. Only the first of those issues, I believe, was pre-inducement. The other four were things that came after the contract was reached. And I think it's important to remember that what the state had to prove at trial was that Mr. Jackson entered into the contract with intent to deceive. There are decisions cited in Morse, specifically the Cash decision, which is a District Court of Appeals from 1997 opinion, that stated that incidents that happened after the inducement can be considered for consent. But Justice Sinter, when he concurred in Morse, did talk about things that happened in the Morse case after the contract was reached. Now, I think that perhaps both the Cash decision and Justice Zinter have valid points. Now, if we look at the post-inducement conduct in the case at bar, what Mr. Jackson did is he spent part of this down payment to hire labor to do the most laborious part of the project, which took 2 days to clear the rock off the roof. He used part of the down payment to rent a dump truck to pay for fuel for that truck. He hauled gravel from the roof to the victim's residence at the victim's request. He rented a trailer to obtain the materials from Minnesota and a machine that he intended to use.
Didn't he get to argue all this to the jury?
Yes, I did. And Chief Justice Gilbertson, I think maybe this is a good time to address your point in the dissenting opinion that a jury's verdict should have deference. Now, I have reviewed Sund v. Weber, which was a habeas decision, but it's one in which the Chief Justice went along with the majority. Now, that case, the reason, it was a very similar case, a construction contract. It wasn't performed, but I'm sure that your reason for joining the majority in that opinion was because of the allegation that the trial counsel was deficient. But I would like to point out, I've been trying cases in criminal court for over 10 years, and in my opinion, jurors at times do not decide cases based on the facts and the law. They decide cases sometimes based on the eloquence or lack thereof of the attorneys, the demeanor of the defendant or the victims. They decide cases because they want to get home to supper. They decide cases because there was improper character evidence admitted.
Does that mean we should not give them deference?
There are times when we should not give them deference, and I think that is why there is a statute that allows the trial court to direct or to enter a judgment of acquittal notwithstanding the verdict. The trial court has that deference. This court has that ability, and this court does as well.
Now, why is this a case where they should not get deference?
I believe, Justice Sabers, that in this case, because the trial court allowed the 404B evidence, I don't believe that was proper. One of the main reasons is that all of the case law cited in Morse, where 404B was allowed, the 404B, the other acts were all prior acts. In the Jackson case, the other act allowed came over 3 years later in time. And the other act allowed was similar in that it was a roofing contract and there was partial performance and there was a down payment, but Jackson's performance in the other act was even greater than with regard to the case before the trial court. And I think that because I addressed this, I believe, in my reply brief, that because the jurors heard that not just on one occasion, but on two occasions, Mr. Jackson took a down payment and didn't complete the contract, I think it's very likely that they decided the case on that point. We won't know for sure because jurors don't issue findings of fact and conclusions of law. They say guilty or not guilty. But I do find it interesting that at this two-day trial, there were 9 witnesses for the state, 6 for the defense, 35 exhibits for the state, 53 exhibits for the defense, and the jurors deliberated for less than 2 hours. So, in my opinion, I don't believe that the jurors applied the facts in evidence to the law when they decided to find Mr. Jackson guilty. I think that the ultimate issue here is, did Mr. Jackson, at the time he induced or entered into the contract with the Eppersons, did he have an intent not to complete the contract? I think it's very important to consider what Mr. Jackson disclosed prior to this contract being executed. He did tell the Eppersons that he did not have all of the equipment needed, that he hoped by getting a contract with the Eppersons and one other contract to have the collateral purchase a machine. He did not hide that from Mr. Epperson. He also disclosed to Mr. Epperson that weather could cause delays in the roofing project. So I think that the only issue where intent to deceive can be found is the statement in the form contract that the down payment is for materials. Now, on that issue, I think the court should consider that when Mr. Jackson used part of the down payment to rent a dump truck, to buy fuel, to hire labor, the victim in this case, Mr. Epperson, did not complain about that. I think it's also helpful to consider, had Mr. Jackson fully completed his obligations under the contract satisfactorily, Mr. Epperson could not have brought a claim for breach of contract because Mr. Jackson didn't use the down payment for materials and nothing else. I think that the court should consider business practices and the fact that Mr. Jackson was an entrepreneur. He was trying to grow a business. The record shows that he was in the roofing business since 1995. He had good standing with the Conklin Company where he intended to get the materials. He had attended their warranty training. He had an ad in the Yellow Pages. And Chief Justice Center, this is one point I wanted to make to distinguish Morse. You pointed out that Mr. Morse hounded the Heffrons to get them to allow him to remodel their house, their bathroom, whereas in the Jackson case, it was Mr. Epperson that found Mr. Jackson in the Yellow Pages, and specifically because of the Conklin name. So when you're considering whether Mr. Jackson intended to deceive, I think that you should consider all those factors, that he had been in the roofing business, he had simultaneous contracts that he completed, that a few months after he accepted this down payment, his business account had excess of the down payment, I think $3,000 more than the down payment. He had other contracts that he was fulfilling at the same time. So I think the Rivers case cited in Morse is helpful because it distinguishes between an intent to deceive or poor business practices. I think that ultimately what the evidence shows is that Mr. Jackson just wasn't very good at conducting business.
Was there evidence that was a reference to other business that he was working on at the same time? Was there evidence that some of those jobs were completed satisfactorily?
Yes, there was.
There was evidence of it, not just... Was there anything documenting it or just the bold assertion of it?
There were, I think, at least five exhibits that are in evidence that were copies of contracts that Mr. Jackson produced, and he testified that the document showed that he completed the contract. So I guess it was evidence produced by Mr. Jackson, but it was in documentary form.
And were some of those contracts for a time period before he contracted with the Eppersons and some after?
Correct.
Thank you.
Now, on the issue of the down payment, there are a few more points that I'd like to stress. Mr. Epperson testified that he believed that the down payment was for materials. But he also believed that the cost of the materials was greater than the down payment. And I've already pointed out he didn't complain when this down payment was used for other purposes. And I think it's important that Mr. Epperson never testified that had he known that Mr. Jackson was not going to use the entire down payment for materials, he would not have entered into the contract. In other words, there is no testimony that Mr. Epperson was induced by that representation in the contract. And it's my argument that by not using that $12,500 for materials, Mr. Jackson perhaps breached a contract, but that does not show that he had the intent to deceive the Eppersons. I think it's important to understand that for this type of project, there are certain steps that have to be completed, and there are certain weather requirements for each step. Mr. Jackson testified that part of the initial delay was due to weather, that because of wet and cold weather, he could not clear the gravel off the roof. And until he cleared the gravel off the roof, he could not apply the polyurethane foam to the roof, and that there were certain weather requirements for applying that foam. And I think it's also important to consider Mr. Jackson's representation to the Eppersons that he didn't have the machine he needed, that he hoped to get two contracts to use as collateral to get the machine. He also disclosed to Mr. Epperson...
Did this disclosure come about before or after they made the down payment?
It came about before. But there was a second disclosure after the down payment was made when Mr. Jackson discovered that he would not get the second contract and therefore could not buy the machine. He told Mr. Epperson that. He advised him that there would be a delay. Now, Mr. Epperson at some point said, well, rent a machine. You contracted to do this. You have an obligation. And I agree that Mr. Jackson, even if he lost money on this project, under this contract, had an obligation to get a machine however he could, even if it cost him more money than he was planning to pay. But that is clearly post-inducement. That's clearly a breach of contract. I don't believe that is evidence of fraudulent intent at the time the contract was entered into. One other point I'd like to make with regard to the Morse decision, it is distinguishable in one in the sense that, or it, because there are statutes, subsections of the statute at issue that were at issue in Morse, subsections 1 and 3, that do not exactly match the Jackson case or the Hearst case, which both involve subsections 1 and 2. Subsection 3 was failing to correct a false impression, so that's not at issue in this case. Subsection 2 is preventing another from acquiring information which would affect the other person's judgment of a transaction. And again, I believe this is pre-inducement, but I don't recall any evidence being presented to support a conviction under subsection 2. So I think that the focus should be on subsection 1, creating or reinforcing a false impression. And again, the only thing we have pre-inducement is the representation that the down payment would be used for materials. Now, this may be arguing the issue a bit too much, but I again would like to mention that the contract that was signed by the parties is a form. There is representations in the contract that are clearly were added by Mr. Jackson, and payment for materials upon signing 50% down before order is placed is not part of the form. It was added. But I would just like to say that that doesn't say materials only. And again, had the project been completed successfully, I don't believe Mr. Epperson could bring a claim for breach of contract because of how the down payment was used. Again, I think we have to consider that the materials for this project have to be stored at a certain temperature, so if Mr. Jackson were to go and purchase them immediately upon receiving the down payment, he would incur other expenses having to store these materials, and he would also incur additional risk because if he did not store them properly, they would be ruined, and that is a significant cost.
Doesn't that kind of beg the question, though, because in the Morris case, if he'd done all the plumbing the way he said he would, if he'd never been prosecuted either?
Yes, I believe it does. But what I'm trying to point out is the use of the down payment is a breach of contract, not evidence of an intent to deceive. And again, Mr. Epperson never testified that had Mr. Jackson not represented that the down payment would be used for only materials, he would not have entered the contract.
Well, certainly the jury could infer that. I mean, you say it's a breach of a contract, but couldn't the jury infer that when the contract itself says that he's going to use the down payment for materials, and he immediately takes $5,000 out for himself, that the jury could say, well, this was his intent from the beginning?
Well, I think they could, but that's the facts of the case are slightly different. What he did was put the $12,500 down payment in a business account that was newly created. I think initially he took out $250 or some small sum. The state pointed out that it was within the first month that there were $5,000 taken. I think there's no evidence that Mr. Jackson did not use that to grow his business, and a few months later that account had more than the down payment, and the jury heard that. I don't know what the jury based their verdict on, but I believe that they did not consider the pre-inducement conduct as much as the evidence that Mr. Jackson failed not just on one contract, but two. And I would like to touch on the 404B issue, which is the second issue I briefed. I found several cases that state that the trial court has to make a record of the balancing test before allowing other acts evidence. And my review of the transcripts in this case does not show that the trial court did that. I think that should this court not agree with my arguments on the sufficiency of the evidence, at a minimum, this case should be remanded for the trial court to make a record on the other acts issue. This is the only case I have been a part of where the prosecutor did not submit actual testimonial evidence, rather than documentary evidence, to support its its motion to include 404 other acts, the other acts evidence. I don't believe that there's anything wrong with that statutorily, but I do believe that that puts the trial court at a disadvantage. And I do believe in this case, the trial court did not spend sufficient time reviewing the documentary evidence that the Attorney General's office provided. One other point, a case I found in South Dakota, PEDDE case, does state that there part of the balancing test is proximity in time. That should be considered. And that wasn't done, so I believe trial court did err in allowing the 404B evidence, and for sure did err in not making a record of its balancing test, if that occurred.
Did you cite that in your brief?
I did not cite that case. I found that when I was reviewing the cases right. cited in Morse.
Then under our rules, you need to provide copies of the case to opposing counsel, and I believe 10 copies to us.
I apologize, Chief
That's
Justice.
Fine. And we'll waive the requirement on Morse because we all know that one.
Okay.
You don't need to furnish us copies on that, but the PD one would be helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dagan.
You know, there were... I have one more question. There were findings of fact, though, that were signed and entered into the record. That is, you don't... Those are you don't feel are sufficient enough to support the trial court's entry of the 404B?
Justice Meyer Henry, if you look closely at that... the date of that document, it was signed after the jury trial.
Okay.
And it was produced by the Attorney General's office. And in my opinion, the trial court did not have sufficient time to review that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Diggins. Mr. Connect, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court?
Counsel?
I think Mr. Diggins is correct in saying that the central issue in this case is Mr. Jackson's intent at the time of entering the contract. I'm going to have to take issue with his argument that in this case we shouldn't defer to the jury verdict. I believe that the South Dakota cases are very clear on, if it's a sufficiency of the evidence case, that we defer to the jury verdict regardless of what we might believe they did or did not do, or what we believe they did or did not consider.
We didn't do that in Morse.
Excuse me?
We didn't do that in Morse.
No. In Morse, I believe that the standard of review for that was used in Morse. I believe that the facts in Morse are distinguishable because in Morse, this court found that there hadn't been, the state had not presented sufficient evidence prior to Morse entering the contract that would show that he had induced the victims in that case to enter the contract. That in that case, the state's theory was that he had misrepresented his licensure as a plumber, and that he had promised plumbing that was above and beyond the code. And this court found that that was simply not sufficient evidence.
How is this case distinguished from Morse?
This case is distinguishable because we do have evidence, and Mr. Dickens referred to it, of the agreement at the time that the Eppersons entered into the contract with Mr. Jackson, that the Eppersons were under the impression that they were making a down payment towards materials. Mr. Epperson testified to that, and that was, I believe, part of State's Exhibit 14, that the down payment was going to go towards materials. And Mr. Jackson himself testified that he considered to be the $5,000 he took in the month of April out of the down payment to be profit.
Why is that deception as opposed to breach of contract?
Well, I'm not saying that it isn't breach of contract as well, but I think it rises to the level of deception because he, at the time, was keeping knowledge from the Eppersons or keeping his intent secret from the Eppersons. He told them this will be going to materials, and then he took the money out and called it profit that he had factored in before he had done any of the work or ordered any of the materials.
But at a later time, he had more money in that account than what they paid on the down payment. So how is it material?
Well, it's material, I believe, because it shows his intent to deceive at the time because... Actually, I'm not sure. Your question is if he had more money in his business account.
Right. So the fact that he took $5,000 out for whatever purposes to grow his business, as opposing counsel says... He had more money in that account than what the down payment was.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I think regarding his business account, first of all, when he made the deposit from the Eversons, there was only, I think, $10 or so in the account. So all of the money in his account at the time he took the profits out came from the Eversons. And it wasn't part of, it wasn't money that was from any other jobs. It was their money that had been, that he had told them was going to the materials. And then later on, I believe Anita Whittington, I believe her name is, the representative from Conklin, the roofing company, she testified that Mr. Jackson told her that he was not planning on purchasing materials because he didn't have funds for it. And I think that's something that needs to be considered in that...
That was prior to the contract?
That was after the contract. That was in September after, I believe he, that at that time... The Eppersons had already filed a report with the police department at that time, but they were still speaking through using Anita as an intermediary. I'm trying to think of how to answer your question better, Your Honor. But as for why that would be considered to be deception is simply because I don't think that the Eppersons would have. And I don't think the jury believed that they would have entered into the contract had they known that he was factoring profits in before purchasing any of the materials.
But they didn't file a complaint once they found out that that he had used some of that money for something other than the buying materials.
No.
They waited for, it was a couple of years later, wasn't it, that they went to, that they filed a complaint?
Well, they filed the original complaint with the Rapid City Police Department that September. As for the complaint that began this case, I think it was several years later. I'm not 100% sure when it was entered.
Okay.
But the point is...
Who tried the case for the state?
The state, that would be Todd Love and Steve Blair from the Attorney General.
So the Attorney General was involved in the trial,
yes.
The prosecution of the case, as
yes.
opposed to just the state's attorney?
Correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Considering the... I believe Mr. Diggins also mentioned several other material facts that were post the inducement of the contract. The first thing he mentioned was the situation with the sprayer, the proper equipment. While the state doesn't argue that the Eppersons knew Mr. Jackson hadn't procured a sprayer at that point, Mr. Jackson had represented to them that he was planning on getting a sprayer by, I think, the 1st of May or so. And then Mr. Diggins made reference to some contracts that fell through, so he couldn't do that. He did not inform the Eppersons that he wouldn't be able to get a sprayer until after the 7th of July, when he was actually supposed to come out and begin spraying the roof. They had agreed on the 24th. Mr. Jackson had came out to clear the gravel off of the roof. And he had told them that he would be out next week to finish spraying the foam on. Now, at that time, the next weekend came and passed, and they had not heard from Mr. Jackson, so they called him, the Eppersons did, and asked if he was planning on spraying the foam. And he said no, he wasn't going to be able to do it, first of all, because the transmission had gone out in his truck, so he wouldn't be able to procure the materials, and second of all, the deal with the spray, the foam sprayer had fallen out. And this wasn't until after the Eppersons had contacted him and asked him about it. And Mr. Diggins also made reference to the fact that later on, I believe in August, when he said, well, I'm not going to be able to get a sprayer until then, Mr. Jackson told them that he wouldn't be able to procure a sprayer until mid-August. And at that time in July, the Eppersons asked him, well, could you rent one? And he said, no, I'm not going to do it because that would cost me more money. And at that point, I believe the situations of the facts that the jury heard about the various things that happened to Mr. Jackson that were out of his control ceased. At that point, it wasn't his truck transmission or other deals falling through that made him unable to continue the job. It was the fact that he didn't want to do it if it was going to cut into his profit margin. And while that in and of itself might be a bad business practice, I believe coupled with the other evidence, a reasonable jury could find that that indicated that he did not intend to complete the roof. As for the 404B evidence, there was discussion of the record that was or was not made at the time. Mr. Diggins, in his brief, cited the case of, I believe, State v. Andrews for that the court was required to make a record of the balancing test. That case, in that case, I believe, is distinguishable because in that case, at a motions hearing, the state had said, we are not planning on introducing other acts evidence. And then when the trial came, the state did try to introduce other acts evidence. Well, in this case, the trial court actually had a hearing and heard testimony from both sides about what this evidence would be and whether or not it should be admitted. And then after that, the court did enter findings of fact, and it's the state's position that.
No, but this was after the fact. That's what
the motions hearing was before the fact. And
but the findings of fact, the actual weighing didn't mm-hmm. wasn't actually in the record until after the hearing, or I mean after the trial.
I'm not sure about that.
The date is according to Mr. Diggins.
Okay.
Let me ask you this on the indictment. This was alluded to by Mr. Diggins, and the different deception, grand theft by deception, and you indicted him on by creating or reinforcing a false impression, including false impressions as to law, value, intention, or other state of mind, or by preventing another from acquiring information which would affect his judgment of a transaction. Is this did you go after all three? Did you argue all three of those elements to the jury, do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I believe we did, just because I believe the course of Mr. Jackson's course of conduct would reflect a guilty verdict under all three of those
elements.
All
three of them, okay.
Yes, the fact that prior to the contract, he induced them to enter the contract by promising that he would use the money for materials and then not doing that at all. The taking of the material, of the down payment for profit, the course of conduct of not informing the Eppersons of developments and what happened. Like I said, on January 7th, the Eppersons had to call him and ask him why he wasn't out there, and he said, well, my truck broke and I don't have the sprayer. And when...
If I was just going to move on to the restitution issue. Assuming we agree with you on the conviction that this, it does amount to a enough sufficient evidence. What about now the bankruptcy dismissing this, mm-hmm. or I mean the debt was dismissed in bankruptcy? How can the restitution be ordered here?
Well, the restitution, I believe, it's perfectly proper for the court to order restitution.
Well, we've not addressed that, have we ever in this court?
Whether
or not the bankruptcy. What effect a bankruptcy, federal bankruptcy, has on ordering restitution?
Not that I'm aware of.
That would be really the first time we've had an opportunity to address that.
Well, I suppose.
And you don't even address this in your brief, do you?
Well, no, because the.
Are you conceding that it can't be ordered?
No, of course not. My argument is that this is a criminal action against Mr. Jackson personally. The jury found Mr. Jackson guilty of theft by deception and by deceiving the Eppersons. Mr. Jackson didn't file for bankruptcy. His business, Four Seasons Roofing, filed for bankruptcy. So I don't think that Mr. Jackson is entitled in any way you read the statute to say that his company filing for bankruptcy somehow shields him from criminal liability in this matter.
Some courts have found that to be the case, however, have they not?
I am not sure about that. I would argue that...
Was the contract with Jackson or his corporation?
The contract, I believe, was with Jackson. But as I think I've said before, this isn't a case of breach of contract. It's a case of theft by deception. And the prosecution is for Mr. Jackson personally having stolen from the Eppersons. He might have used his business as a tool or as a cover, but he didn't certainly... It wasn't the corporate officers of the business deciding to do something or anything like that. It was him personally who deceived them, and the jury found that he was liable for that crime. that, I think I've said enough on those issues. If you have any questions at all.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Knack.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Diggins, you have 10 minutes, sir.
The court has raised several points which I would like to address. First of all, I do have a copy of the contract, and it is in evidence, and the contract is between Four Seasons Roofing Incorporated and St. Joe Antiques and Gift Shop. It is signed by Kim Jackson and Doris Epperson.
And he signed as president of the corporation?
It is not. It's authorized signature and then his signature with no qualification. The bankruptcy issue I found very challenging because I did not find any South Dakota case law on point. I attempted to speak with attorneys who dealt with bankruptcy, and they had never encountered the issue. Bankruptcy, as you know, is a federal court issue. But I think that one thing that is important is the timing of the bankruptcy. It is accurate, as Mr. Connect stated, that the first complaint that the Eppersons made was to the Rapid City Police Department. That was in the fall or late summer of 2002. And I think it's important to note that the Pennington County State's Attorney's Office declined to prosecute this, in my opinion, because they felt it was civil. But the if I can find my notes, I know that I set forth the timing on the bankruptcy issue. And if you're not interested in exact dates, I do remember what happened as far as complaints being made. The Eppersons complained first to the Pennington County authorities, next to the Attorney General's office. It was after that complaint reached the Attorney General that Mr. Jackson filed for bankruptcy. Mr. Jackson's, the debt was discharged, and then the indictment was filed, and he was prosecuted.
Mr. Jackson's debt wasn't discharged. It's important to stay with the right entities here. Only the corporation was discharged, right?
Correct. I apologize. Okay.
So how can you claim the court cannot order restitution against Mr. Jackson, who's found guilty of something, when only the corporation was discharged and he was not discharged in bankruptcy?
Justice Sabers, I understand that argument, but I think it is important to note that Mr. Jackson was the sole officer of this corporation, that the Eppersons were noticed in the bankruptcy proceeding, that the debt that was noticed was the down payment. So we have, in fact, the same parties, perhaps with different titles.
Was the bankruptcy Mr. Jackson doing business as, or as a corporate officer of Four Seasons?
I don't believe so. It was okay. Four Seasons.
Well, are you?
Are there no cases whatsoever in the whole United States that deal with the situation where the corporation's been discharged in bankruptcy, but a circuit court judge comes along and orders restitution against an individual who ran that corporation?
I would have to say there are cases that support that position.
That support the discharge even though it's a separate entity?
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke. There are cases that I've found where there is a bankruptcy and also a criminal proceeding, and the criminal proceeding is allowed to go forward. Mr. Jackson pointed out to me that it was his feeling that because he was part of a corporation, that shielded him from personal liability. And I made the point to him, well, if you're driving to work and you're speeding as a part of a corporation, you can still be convicted of speeding. It doesn't shield you from criminal liability. But what is important here, in my opinion, is that criminal proceedings cannot be used to collect debts once they've been discharged. And I understand that Mr. Jackson is charged criminally and it was his corporation in the bankruptcy, but I still think it's important that the debt is the same debt.
What if you go out and rob a bank? Can you avoid restitution then by filing bankruptcy?
No.
What's the difference from this case where the jury
called
your client?
In bankruptcy proceedings, there are provisions for creditors to go to the bankruptcy court and say, you cannot discharge this debt, it was fraudulent. And in your example, Chief Justice, I believe that's what the bank would do. They would go to the bankruptcy court and say, this debt is fraudulent, do not discharge it. There are other debts that cannot be discharged. For example, if I had been convicted of a crime, was ordered to pay restitution, then filed bankruptcy, I cannot discharge that restitution order.
So you're saying the Epperson should have come into the bankruptcy court because they had notice and argued that Mr. Jackson couldn't be discharged because it was because he was fraudulent, not the Four Seasons Corporation.
Correct.
But you didn't find any cases going that way. You only found cases going the other way.
Well, I did find a case which I cited in my brief that talks about the motivation of the prosecution, that prosecutors should not be bringing criminal charges to collect debts that have been discharged. And in my opinion, that's what happened here. But to be in all candor, I have no expertise in bankruptcy, and I did struggle with that issue. I did my best on it.
Your argument is we don't even get there, right? Because
well, yes.
there was no fraud at the time of the agreement to deceive these people.
That
just was incompetent to complete the job.
That's correct, Justice Sabres. That is my main argument, that this is a breach of contract case. There was no fraudulent inducement. There was poor business management or bad business practices.
There's been a question as to whether or not the State versus Morse case is distinguishable. What's your argument on that?
Well, I believe that Morse is the precedent to be overcome here. The Jackson case provides this court with an opportunity to expand on its ruling in Morse. And I found no case in South Dakota more on point than Morse to the Jackson case. And I do think that Justice Sinter's concurring opinion categorizing the conduct, pre-inducement and post-inducement, is helpful. And I do think that all you're left with is the representation in the contract regarding the down payment. And I've spoken at length on that issue, but to say it one more time, I believe that shows a breach of contract, not fraudulent inducement. I can tell you also that the date on the court's findings is 21 June 2007, non proton, April 18, 2007. I believe April 18 was the hearing where there was no testimony, there was argument, and documentary evidence was submitted to the court. The jury trial happened in May, so there was a hearing on 404B before the trial, but no testimony from the witnesses who offered testimony at the trial.
It's not uncommon, though, for trial courts to in the hustle bustle of getting ready, to make decisions and then flesh out the details later. I mean, we can't draw adverse inferences from the fact that the formal findings weren't entered until later, can we?
No, I would agree with that, but I also think that the timing does support my argument that the trial court didn't fully consider the other acts evidence before the trial. And again, the trial court did not make a record of its balancing of probative value versus prejudice, which in all the precedent I've seen from this court, that is required. Mr. Connect made a point about Mr. Jackson telling an employee of Conklin that he didn't have the funds to purchase the materials. I don't know that that's accurate, but I think what should be pointed out is Mr. Jackson was contacted by Toby Karn at the Pinion County State's Attorney's Office. He returned the phone call. He explained the situation to Mr. Karn. He was contacted by Agent Romer from Division of Criminal Investigation. He spoke with Agent Romer. He did not, as in the Craver case cited in Morse, flee the state once he learned law enforcement was involved. He attended to his problems, and I think that's further evidence that he had no fraudulent intent. He just had a great deal of difficulty completing his obligations under this contract. I see that I have just a few seconds left, and I would like to just thank you all for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Diggins. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.